Today on Against the Grain, anarchist rabble-rouser, maverick woman doctor and abortion provider, political prisoner and out lesbian at the turn of the 20th century, Marie Ecuy was a remarkable figure who has only recently been recovered from the amnesia of history. I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Michael Hellquist will join me to talk about the turbulent life and times of a pioneering radical. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Marie Ecuy is one of the most fearless American radicals you've never heard of. A contemporary of Emma Goldman and of working class origins, Ecuy was a doctor when few women were, and provided women with abortions and information about birth control when it was illegal. She was an anarchist, an opponent of militarism, ready to put her body on the line for her ideas. And she was an out lesbian at a time when the word didn't exist, adopting a child with her longtime lover. Because of all of these things, the state singled her out for particularly harsh repression. At the age of almost 50, she was sent to San Quentin under the Sedition Act of 1918 for her opposition to World War I. If she's not been completely lost to history, it may largely be due to the efforts of journalist and historian Michael Hellquist. He's the author of the first full-length biography of her, titled Marie Ecuy, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions, published by Oregon State University Press. And he joins me today. Michael, Marie Ecuy was born to an Italian father and an Irish mother in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Tell us about her origins and how she ended up in the West.
Well, so she was in this immigrant family in New Bedford, which is a very wealthy city. She was born in 1872, and this was a time when there were not many Italians in the country. This was sort of the first wave. And one of the defining factors of her childhood is that she felt her family was ostracized by the main community for being too Irish, and then by the Irish for being too Italian. So she felt, had this sense, she later said, of being an outsider. They were working class, a large family. Her mother gave birth to 11 children over 16 years. She was in the middle. And she was able to finish grade school, begin, and complete 1 year of high school. And then her parents insisted that she drop out and work in the textile mills. In those days, New Bedford was a huge textile mill city. So she did that. She was an earnest and eager student, and she hated leaving, but she worked in the textile mills for 2 years, was miserable. And then a girlfriend of hers, a few years older, from a more well-off family, rescued her. And one of the things she did following year was to invite her to come to a homestead in Central Oregon with her. So this was Marie Ecuy's escape from the textile mills, because she knew there were no jobs suitable for her. She didn't want to get married. She knew from early on she didn't try to date or allow suitors to seek her company. And she knew she had no future there. So, and besides, she got to go out west and be with her girlfriend. So that was in 1892, these two women living together outside the small town of The Dalles, Oregon. And
tell listeners what you mean by a homestead.
Right. In the mid-1800s and then into the early 1900s, the government encouraged people from the Midwest and the East Coast to come out into the frontier West first, early on, and to stake a claim, which meant, depending on which program they were filing under, they could get 100 acres, say, or maybe 20 acres. And
so this is land which the native people have been dispossessed from.
Right. That had already occurred. And when Bessie Holcomb got her land, and the notion was that people would stay on the land, usually for a period of about 5 years, and then improve it, and at the end of the 5 years, if they could show that they had done so, it was called proving up your claim, they were given title to the land. They were the owners. So Bessie Holcomb bought a title. It was already a few owners or generation removed from early Native Americans. And Marie Ecwe joined her. And then at some point, she decided she wanted to study medicine. This is someone with basically about a year and a half, 2 years of high school, because she took some extra schooling in Massachusetts.
And a woman.
And so not only didn't anyone encourage or expect women to become doctors, if they must have a profession, they were urged to be teachers or nurses. But she was also working class, which is really out of the ordinary. And Marie stepped above her station, in a sense, and she self-studied her way into medical school. They moved to San Francisco after their 5 years on the homestead, and she passed the entry exam, which was all that was required. She was fortunate at the time that a teaching certificate wasn't needed and a high school diploma wasn't needed. You just needed to pass the entry exam. So she did go to school for 2 years in San Francisco, two different medical colleges. The last one is now UCSF up on Parnassus Heights. She was there when there were only three buildings on Parnassus Heights in 1900. And then for some reason that we're not sure of, she relocated to Portland on her own. She was accompanied by another woman student who was she was very close to. The relationship is a little uncertain, but she did leave San Francisco for Portland and complete her medical schooling there.
So she must have been in quite a minority as a female student in these medical programs.
She definitely was, although ironically, in her graduating class at the University of Oregon Medical Department, there were 10 students, 5 men and 5 women. Hmm. That just didn't happen very often.
And she then used her medical training in ways that were explicitly political. So I want to ask you, how did she become politicized and how did her politics shift in these early years?
Good question. And I'd only say partly from her background in New Bedford, she had an orientation to workers and to some strikes. She would say that her father brought strikers home to the family dinner. So she had some exposure to it. When she got established in Portland, she got involved with politics the way many professional women at the time did. It was progressive politics. This was in the early 1900s. Portland and Oregon were the center of progressive politics.
And progressive, are you meaning progressive as that term would be understood at that time or today? Perhaps you could define it.
Right. More so as it was understood then. It was definitely a sense of bringing more direct power to the people. So there are similarities. For instance, the initiative and referendum got started there, and people were working about that. They called it direct democracy. Some of the words were similar. Progressivism then did not suggest any more radical ideas as overthrowing the government, but working within the government for civic reform and social justice. So as many other professional women did, she got involved first with women's suffrage, which was determined state by state at that time. And it took Oregon 6 attempts to pass women's suffrage. She was involved in the last 2 campaigns. But her interests were broader than that. And you are right, she leveraged her professional position to push her causes, knowing that she was unusual, a woman doctor, people paid attention to her. And she took advantage of that. She also worked for things like an 8-hour workday with the state legislature and funding for the state university, supporting progressive candidates. So she was on that track. It was more liberal than the norm, but from our view today, it was pretty mainstream also.
So how did she end up identifying as an anarchist?
It was an interesting occasion for her. Here she was a doctor, and she was called out to help a patient on the east side of Portland, which was working class Portland, and this was in 1913. And she walked by a fruit cannery where women were picketing, women workers were picketing. Some of them were her patients, and they called her to join them and step up on the soapbox. And she did so, and with that step, she virtually changed her life because of the events that followed. And in the days ahead, the women were attacked by the police. And then the radical union group, Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, got involved and supported the women, but also shifted it to a free speech fight in downtown Portland. And Equi joined that. And she got beaten by police. And she later said, that she entered this strike as a socialist, but she came out of it as an anarchist. And she had this quote, "No man will tell me what to do." So it was a very personal thing, the radicalization. And, you know, an interesting thing about Equi was that she was fluid in her politics. She was not an ideologue. She was not a theorist, necessarily. She wasn't an Emma Goldman, although she crossed paths with Emma Goldman and respected her. So sometimes I think she could say, you know, "I support this socialist action, and then here I am an anarchist, but then here I am getting involved in electoral politics." That was a world. So it was fluid.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Michael Hellquist. He is the author of Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. That's published by Oregon State University Press. So I wonder if you could paint a picture of radicalism at the beginning of the 20th century, the time when really you're talking about where Marie Equi became increasingly radicalized and increasingly active. What did radical politics, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, look like at that time?
Well, you know, people were fully aware of the harm and the injustice that accompanied much of industrialization and capitalism. And there was just a huge amount of organizing. It seemed more possible to be radical. It was a range of political involvements for people at the time. But in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of it's centered around agriculture, but especially the forests. Different from the East Coast. So you had a lot of transient men trying to find jobs and women in agriculture and canneries trying to get jobs and then suffering from the low wages, the deplorable working conditions, and the rest. That tended to radicalize people, and some just wanted an improvement in their conditions, which is understandable. They were just trying to get through their day and support themselves and their families. Others said, you know, small improvements isn't going to do it. It's the whole economic order that needs to be changed. And she moved into that direction. And the Industrial Workers of the World had a very strong base in Portland and in the Pacific Northwest for about a decade. And one of the first strikes by the IWW in Portland was, I believe, in 1907. And so even before Equi got involved, it was in the environment, in the newspapers. People talked about it. She understood that. Plus, Emma Goldman, on her national tours, stopped in Portland every year. And she freely spoke about radical elements. Sometimes she met resistance. Sometimes she was jailed, Emma Goldman. But generally, she was able to talk about her anarchism and her beliefs in it. So it was kind of a bubbling over, and with the labor rights push, things got more fierce, more violent by the forces of capitalism, more violent, and it kept building kind of up to the point, and including the point of getting ready for World War I. So it was a tense time, but it also seemed to be a time of possibility.
And we'll talk more about all the politics around World War I as we go on. But I wonder if you could describe the reigning ideas of the time, because the left at that time was not as polarized as it later became between people who might identify as socialists. You even kind of alluded to this in Equi's own politics, communists, anarchists. So a group like the IWW, what sort of politics were they advocating, and to what degree did it range beyond just the politics of the workplace?
For the IWW, it was mostly I believe, mostly about the workplace. And they were not as organized a force as we might believe that they had been. Free speech was really important to them, and they often staged challenges on street corners and see what would happen and then start a battle.
And what did free speech mean to them? Was this the right to organize and to speak to organize?
It was simply the right to get on a soapbox on the street corner and say whatever they wanted to say. And usually what would happen is one speaker would get up, the police would come along, pull him or her off, and cart them off to jail. Another one would get up, and that would continue. So it was a constant battle. And then Portland also had a mayor who wasn't just concerned about free speech and whether people were saying or proposing the wrong change. He didn't like the words they were using. So it offended him. It was obscenities to him. That sort of charged him up even more. And he would tell people, you cannot go out and you can't speak that way or you will be arrested. And that were a few of the occasions when Ekwe got arrested and was beat up on the street and in jail during a third-degree process and radicalized her even more.
In terms of the kind of larger ideas of the time, you mentioned Emma Goldman. Mm-hmm. She was someone who clearly identified as an anarchist. And her politics were very much what might be seen in this day as workerist. But it didn't just stop there, because she had all sorts of very strong views about sexuality. Yeah,
very much so.
The place of women in society. I wonder if you could just give us a sense of that kind of wide-ranging ideas, because you said that it wasn't just oppositional, but there was a sense of possibility to transform the world. So in a sense, there was a kind of utopian element, not just a saying no, but a yes.
Well, one thing to think of, not to overwork the IWW, but their notion was for one big union, which meant not just the trade unionist movement, which is standard today as well, but more this notion that we have one big group that represents us all. And I think that typified a lot of the notion of radicalism, that we should all move forward, we should all be in the boat lifting up, we should all get the benefits of a job and housing and the adequate resources that we need. So there was a hopeful sense there. Certainly, as today, there was an extremist view that wanted violent overthrow of the government. There were others who thought violence could be used in particular circumstances, and Emma Goldman had pursued that in her life as well. And so I think the really sense is the potential, the opening up, and then, of course, that did enter into social life and certainly sexual life for Emma Goldman. And it's one of the things that I think was really important about Ekwe is that she didn't give a lot of speeches and talks and writings like Emma Goldman, but she lived her life that way. I mean, just to reflect, back a moment, when she was in the Dalles, Oregon, on the homestead, there was a ruckus that was caused there that she was involved in, and she and her girlfriend appeared in the newspapers, and it was described, their living circumstances were described, and I believe that was the first case where, in the public, where same-sex intimate relationship was presented, and this was 1893. And then Ekwe was involved in another such case in Portland in 1906. So I think it was really important that either because of her independence and determination, but also the times, that in some ways she could live openly with a woman and not fear it.
Well, let me ask you more about her sexuality. She, in many ways, was a trailblazer in loving whom she wanted to and actually creating a family that went against traditional norms of families. How was lesbianism viewed at that time? And how might it differ to the way that lesbianism has been viewed in our times?
Interestingly, during her time in the 1890s and early 1900s, lesbian and lesbianism wasn't a words that were used. So it's like we don't have a language to talk about what we see going on here. But it was also at an early point where in psychological and sexological circles, the different sex choices, preferences, whatever you want to call it, weren't as defined. So it was a little fluid state already. Now, equi living with someone on a small homestead, some people have referred to that as a Boston marriage, which was more popular in the Boston area, but that usually involved wealthy women, independent women already, which didn't really apply.
So this is a union between women, upper-class women.
Right, and without the need to rely on men.
And a term that was used without great scorn?
In certain circles, maybe respectable circles, it was just something that happened. But for Equi, she was doing this on her own in her own way. She was working class. And I think that was remarkable, and it ties into how she actually throughout her life, coincident to the program name, she really was against the grain. She was an outsider most of her life, and the sexuality part really kept her there, so that even when she became a professional and a doctor and you'd think outsider no more, actually she still was. So I think with women, people didn't talk about it very much. And women living together was often considered just something that was done. They were waiting for a husband. People just didn't. Or there would be gossip and there would be talk. But I think it's only when Equi became so public and then so political and controversial, then all these things started coming together, and she ultimately was referred to as a degenerate and an unsexed woman, and she ran into the full brunt of her relationships. And I think she's the first publicly known lesbian of her time on the West Coast. And it's not so important to be identified as the first, but it does help establish some ground of people, we were there, that sort of thing.
And especially as it intersects with a radical politics.
Especially.
Which viewed sexuality as and sexual liberation as part of a larger project.
It did. It wasn't necessarily a priority for a lot of radical individuals and organizations, but women were involved. People like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn were really pushing all the time to get more people involved with the IWW and the Communist Party later.
So one place where Marie Equi was quite active around sexuality was in her medical work. She provided abortions and birth control information at a time when such things were actually illegal. Can you tell us about the medical work that she did and how she viewed it through her political lens?
Well, the first part of it is easier to answer. She had a general practice, but it was the norm at the time that most women doctors would mostly be serving women and children and then families, which sometimes involved husbands and et cetera. But she was never solely just dealing with women. And it's important that she did get involved with providing abortions. And we can't pinpoint when she did. It was sometime between 1905 and 1915. And at that time, it certainly was illegal in the city. And she provided safe, discreet abortions, and early in term. So I think they were very safe. It was pretty simple, relatively simple procedure. And she didn't get in trouble with the law. There were larger operations, just abortion operations. Sometimes some people called them abortion mills. She always did it individually. And other doctors who were protecting their reputation would refer their patients to her so that she could take what risk there was and perform them. And with birth control, it was also illegal to distribute birth control information. And actually this year, this summer, will be the 100th anniversary of when Margaret Sanger first went on a national tour, arrived in Portland, gave a talk. Her supporters started to distribute her birth control pamphlet called Family Limitation, and they were arrested. And it set in motion a series of events where a second talk by Sanger both Sanger and Ekwe and other women were arrested simply for distributing these pamphlets that said how to with the information and technology and products available at the day. So I don't know of any other doctor in Portland, I'm sure there were some elsewhere, who not only helped women with birth control, but fought with them in the streets, marched through town, went to jail. So again, she was a little bit protected having her professional status, but you know, it didn't help her in the eyes of some people either.
Well, birth control is one place where radical history can get a little complicated because people like Margaret Sanger, Emma Goldman, the people who believe that they were helping women seize control of their destiny by allowing them to have this fundamentally important information. But then someone like Sanger also ended up supporting eugenics, which was a, you know, politics around saying that certain undesirable people should not reproduce, you know, the poor generally, the ethnically outside. Are you aware if Marie Ekwe ever was an advocate of eugenics as well? I know she was close to Sanger, perhaps even involved with her romantically at some point.
I don't know for sure that she was. And I think it's a little tricky area. It's a nuanced area with Margaret Sanger. I think most of her time in her association, early association with Ekwe, the conflict about eugenics wasn't as developed. I think Margaret Sanger shifted in her own life from being more radical to being more conservative, and so I think it wasn't happening right about at that period. And I think even her support was pretty nuanced about what did she really mean and who was she talking about. And it's easier to kind of capsulize it and say she was in favor of eugenics. That's sort of the context, I think, is important there.
That's the voice of Michael Hellquist. We'll return with him in just a moment.
So soon on the Dunbar end, everyone sang. When strangers became your new best friends, everyone sang. It was Armistice Day and peace broke out, everyone sang. Sometimes a melody is louder than a shout.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with independent scholar and author Michael Hellquist, who's author of the first full-length biography of the anarchist lesbian doctor Marie Ekwe, who was born in 1872 and died in 1952. And I should say Ekwe is spelled E-Q-U-I. And my name is Sasha Lilly. So, Michael, let's turn now to the lead-up to World War I, which was a very politically charged period in U.S. history. And of course, a time when there had been a great deal of radical ferment. And in the wake of it, as we'll get to, a lot of that ferment was sort of beaten back. How did someone like Marie Ekwe view the U.S.'s turn towards entering World War I? And how did they swim against the current of politics around them?
I think she viewed it through the prism of capitalism. Who's to benefit from this war begun in Europe among European powers, among European capitalists, and what are the forces that are urging, encouraging the U.S. to enter the war? What are the domestic forces? And I think she was pretty sharp, pretty clear about that. And leading up to World War I, there was a period certainly of isolationism in the country, and Americans weren't sure that they wanted to have the country jump into the war, but there was this interim phase, this initial phase called preparedness. And not everyone, certainly, but a majority of Americans thought, well, yes, we don't know if we want to go to war, but if we must, we want to be prepared. And it became this national, hyper-nationalism surge in every city, small city and large city, hosted what were called preparedness parades 100,000 people marching down the street, and you know, it was festive, and it was determined, and people were unified, and it was a good feeling for all of them in there. Those big group in Portland didn't include Marie Ecuy. On the Preparedness Day parade in Portland, there were 50,000 people who came out, filling up 40 city blocks. Not a great number, 15,000 for us today, but Portland was a much smaller town, of course. It was a big deal. And there were one contingent after another of different interest groups going through downtown. Ecuy started the day. She had a big car, and she had signs festooned on it. She did have an American flag on the front, but then on the side, she had a sign that was basically saying, "Capitalists want you to join the war, you know, for their own good, and thou shalt not kill." So after driving around Portland, she came into downtown Portland, and she maneuvered her car behind an attorney's group, and I think it was the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic group. So there she was, all by herself. There was no other known dissent in the parade but her, with this big car, and she's, "Here I am." And, you know, the interesting thing is she knew from the 1913 cannery strike that men would not hesitate to beat her up. It had happened. She knew that the police would not protect her. In fact, back then, they took her into the police station and beat her up more. So even knowing that, she still did it. And I think it's remarkable. I mean, it might seem risky, reckless, but definitely bold, courageous. And it's what she thought should be done. So she was there within, I don't know how long, a few minutes. 50 angry men surrounded her. And she was a slight woman, about 5'3", 5'4". 50 angry men yelling at her. They ripped the banner off her car and the one she was carrying, ripped it to shreds, and then thrust the American flag in her face that had been on the street and was dirty. And they said, "Kiss this." And then they said, "Well, rip this apart," because they were, I guess, were trying to get evidence against her. And she just said, "No," said, "your flag is no protection for me." And she got beat up. And the police finally intervened and broke it up, and the parade went on. But it was that kind of determination on her part, and the national spirit was greater. So, and that was like in 1916. The U.S. entered the war in 1917. So that was early on. And, of course, that radicalized her more, and she had more of a platform then. So she spoke out against the war. The IWW didn't take a strong position against the war. They wanted to focus on their issues, and they thought, capitalists are fighting with capitalists. We don't really care what, that's simplifying it some, but we don't really care what the outcome is. And it was interesting, a conflict that also developed for Ecuy. Here she was, a longtime suffragist. Oregon women had already won the right to vote in 1912, but nationally, it was still pending. So in the election of 1916, President Woodrow Wilson, the incumbent, was running against Charles Evans Hughes for the Republican side. And Wilson would not commit to the federal suffrage amendment, but he was making these statements, I kept the country out of the war, suggesting that he would again. And Charles Evan Hughes from the Republican side had endorsed the suffrage amendment. So in the suffrage camp, most women went to Charles Evans Hughes to take care of their issue. Ecuy did just the opposite. She went with Woodrow Wilson because he was supposedly against the war. And it just shows some of the clashes that were going on in the movements at the time, similar to today, people taking sides and what that meant for them.
What you describe of how Ecuy took on solo this patriotic crowd, one could say mob, or it seems mm-hmm. like it turned into a mob, she seems like an exceptionally fearless person, and not just in that moment, obviously living her life out of the closet the way she did,
was one aspect of that. But she also seemed like someone who was really not afraid of risking her physical well-being for her principles. I want to talk more about World War I, but, you know, that's really very striking.
I think it was a matter of priorities in her mind. Do the right thing. And it was also this edge about her is of, don't push me around. You know, that was just, it was fierce. Call it independence, call it oversensitivity to conflict, whatever. But she was determined about that. And I think she didn't want to show her fear. So she often appears fearless, like she didn't give it a second thought. She later talked in letters to Margaret Sanger and to others of how frightening it was and how, like, when she got this third-degree treatment from the police, that, like, she said her womanhood revolted because of the treatment to her, and she was terrified about it. So there was this vulnerability that didn't show as often because she presented herself as strong, indomitable. It was partly her defense.
So, of course, Woodrow Wilson actually did take the U.S. into World War I. And as a consequence, there was a very intense backlash against the left, against radicals, under the umbrella of the nation standing together. Tell us about that. A Red Scare in many ways, more intense than the McCarthy period.
Yes, it was. Once the U.S. entered the war, the national spirit and unity shifted. Support our boys, support the national effort. And it became as intense, if not more so, than the kind of hyper-nationalism around the preparedness. And it was a time when little dissent was allowed. And partly in the early stages of the war, the president and the president's men decided that they had to keep convincing the American public that the war was a good thing, because not everyone moved from isolationism to support of the war. And one way to do that was a communications campaign that put out the pro-war statements. The other part was to slap down dissent. And in time, Congress passed the Espionage Act and then the Sedition Act, which together virtually said you cannot criticize anything the government does, anything. Publicly, you cannot do that. And you cannot stir up conflict or criticize any of the war industries, which, of course, could be most anything. The war, who's supporting the war and not? Most everyone was, if only for commercial reasons, the businesses were. So it was really a clampdown on, certainly on free speech, but it got to the point where protesters, where people could not gather in like more than three at a time in a public space and talk about their opposition to the war or anything else.
And what were the consequences for Marie Equi?
For Marie Equi, it meant that she was arrested and she was charged under the Sedition Act. And basically, she was charged with speaking out against the war. No one said she wasn't charged with working with a small group that was going to blow up some building. No one said that she was calling for the overthrow of the government. She was opposing the capitalists. She was opposing things like the Liberty Loan efforts to raise money for the war. And she was charged. She went to trial. It dragged out for quite a while. And then she was convicted by an all-male jury. And she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. President Wilson commuted her sentence to a year and a day, and the day had something to do with her eligibility for early release. And she ended up going to San Quentin, which she was actually pleased to go to San Quentin. There was another prison in the Midwest, I think in Iowa, that was more of a reform prison or rehabilitation. She said, I'm too old to reform. Just send me to prison in San Quentin, and I know the Bay Area. I'm fine.
Why do you think Wilson reduced her sentence?
Partly because the war was ended. And she was a doctor. She had a lot of supporters, especially once the war was not really an issue of something we were fighting anymore. And there was a lot of flack being sent to Washington, to the Attorney General and to Wilson. And so he didn't pardon her, but he did reduce her sentence. And even though I say that she was charged and convicted of sedition, you get the sense through her trial and other documentation that I got, this was really about silencing a troublesome woman. Her anti-war statements were the hook. But here was this open lesbian. Here was this relatively well-known abortion provider. Here's this one who was in the labor strikes, was involved with the Wobblies. They just didn't want to deal with her, and they feared her because she had power. People listened to her.
We're speaking about the anarchist and lesbian doctor Marie Equi, who lived her life primarily in the Pacific Northwest and was incarcerated, as is just being described, during World War I in San Quentin. My guest is the author of the first full-length biography of her. The book is called Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. His name is Michael Hellquist. He is a journalist and historian, and I am Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you have written that Equi was exceptional in being incarcerated in San Quentin. Now, obviously, there was a great deal of repression that was taking place, but it seems like she particularly, as you've just been noting, was targeted for a particularly high level of repression.
Correct. She was not the only woman to be incarcerated, certainly. She wasn't the only woman from Oregon to be. In San Quentin, which still had women prisoners, inmates there, she was the only one on these charges. They were called politicals. It was a small population, but she was the only one there. And historians have been able to get copies of her correspondence for 4 months from prison. And you get a picture of her life in prison, but it's also pretty clear that she knew they were being read and censored as need be. And I think for her friends who she was writing to, she mostly kept a pretty upbeat appraisal of what she was dealing with. But with a few, she would talk about the severe difficulties she had. She said she had to force herself to not think about no longer being a doctor at her practice and to not think about the injustice done to her, or she would just revert to what she called a brain fever. It was just so upsetting for her.
Obviously, prison is hard on people's bodies. And for her, it took a physical toll as well as an emotional one.
Definitely. I mean, here is a 50-year-old woman who was sent to prison. And this wasn't San Quentin for the women. It wasn't like some of the other prisons where women had to work 8 to 10 hours a day, laundromat or sewing or whatever. If anything, they didn't have much to do at all. They were kind of in a concrete box, and they could look up and see the sky out in the courtyard in Marin, but that was all. It had to have been really difficult for her, who partly was accustomed at that time to finer, to say like to better eating, to good quality food. She wasn't able to get that there. And, you know, there would just be so much noise. You know, it would make it difficult to rest. She talked about in the first several weeks, she was terrified when in her cell, the door was shut at night. She was so claustrophobic, it just kind of freaked her out. And I think it just took a huge psychological strain. Plus, the whole time, she was trying to get out of prison while she was incarcerated. And this is a time when all she had access to was writing letters, maybe every now and then a telephone call. And she was trying to coordinate it. I mean, imagine today trying to coordinate the paperwork and you talk to you. And that made her a little crazy in a sense, too, because it was so difficult and people didn't follow through and there were glitches and et cetera.
To what degree did her life change upon her release from prison?
Well, the world had changed, not only for her, but certainly for other radicals. She wasn't really able to be politically active, certainly to the same degree, because the post-war Red Scare was just as frightening as before. People were not able to gather, were not able to talk among each other or to the public. She told Margaret Sanger that anyone who had a public hall would be threatened with closure if they let her speak or anyone else speak. So she was really shut down that way. And initially, she wasn't sure if she wanted to go back to her medical practice. She thought she might work for prison reform instead, and she did that for a few months. But others were already on the prison reform circuit. So she went back to what she knew best, to the practice of medicine. And she continued that for as long as her health held out, until 1930, when she had a heart attack and retired from her practice, although she was to live for another 20 years.
Tell us about her last years. She had become close to someone who you've mentioned already, the leader of the IWW, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who herself was on a changing political trajectory.
Right. Well, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was younger than Equi by several years, she was the hero of the IWW. She started speaking out on these issues when she was 16, and this young woman was, you know, all these men working out in the forest and everything else, and they had this young woman who would speak their cause. It was amazing for them. So she was very popular. She was a national figure, whereas Equi was more regional and local. But in 1927, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was traveling through the country, and by the time she got to Portland, she was having health problems and almost the equivalent of a nervous breakdown because of all the stress involved of failed relationships, personal relationships on her part, and the politics in the country at the time. And she ended up stopping in Portland and asking Marie Equi to take care of her. And she did have some severe health problems, seemingly first with her heart and then with something even like an infected tooth, which the infection then spread throughout the body. So one doctor that Marie arranged, a specialist that Marie arranged for Gurley Flynn to see, said you have to have bed rest for 5 years because there were no medications or any treatments. The important thing, and Gurley Flynn stayed there with Equi on and off for a period of 9 years. So Gurley Flynn resigned from all of her political activities. And there they were on this hillside outside on the edge of Portland in Equi's house. She had a house at that time. And they spent all these years there. Partly Equi took care of Gurley Flynn, and then Gurley Flynn took care of Equi after her heart attack. But the important thing is that this was also during the Depression. And Gurley Flynn really had nowhere else to go. Her family in New York did not have money to support her. And Equi gave her free lodging, free board and large lodging, and said, please help me out with the house and maybe some of the books for my business and that sort of thing. And they developed a very complicated, what might appear now, a codependent relationship now. And some people, especially relatives of Gurley Flynn, was really concerned that Gurley Flynn's reputation would be tarnished by living with this lesbian, you know, and all the terrible things that could happen as a result. So it was a pretty interesting time in her life also.
Well, in the last minutes that we have, I'd like to ask you how you came to know about Marie Equi, because she's not someone who has either been celebrated by the radical left or the lesbian and gay community, at least as far as I'm aware. And yet, you know, she's a really remarkable figure. How did you come across her?
The first thing, what triggered my interest is I went to a website from the Pacific Northwest called the Gay Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest. And there was an article there about the period when Equi was on the homestead in Oregon. And at that time, her girlfriend was a school teacher, and she was not being paid a full salary by the superintendent. They tried to get the money. And finally, Equi said, enough of this. She grabbed a horsewhip, and she horsewhipped this guy, who also happened to be a Baptist minister, in the center of town in the middle of the day. and became a local heroine for doing so because he was kind of a fraudulent character. So my first orientation was, let's see, 21-year-old lesbian horsewhipping Baptist minister to defend her girlfriend. Okay, I want to know more. But then the other thing was that I really connected was this, on a more personal level, is Ekwe was this outsider because of her background, her working class background, and her sexuality. And I personally identified with that. And I wanted to know, how did she manage this 100 years ago? How did this happen? And then, why isn't her story known? And I think partly, or a good part of the reason why her story isn't better known was because of her outlaw sexuality, because she was lesbian and others didn't want to deal with that. Plus, to a lesser degree, her radical politics. I mean, certainly Goldman and Gurley Flynn were radical. I think it was the lesbian part that kept her at a distance. And another factor was there weren't as many sources from her life. Her journals had been thrown away, and that discouraged people. But obviously, it's possible to put a life together, even if you don't have all the documentation that you would like, and keep someone from being hidden from history.
And for someone who would like to know more about that hidden history heretofore, you can check out Marie Ekwe, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. It's published by Oregon State University Press, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Its author is Michael Hellquist, journalist and historian. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.